Welcome to this Building Green podcast. My name is Tristan Roberts, editorial director for Building Green. I researched and wrote our new article, Know Thy Client, 9 Ungreen Strategies for Delivering Better Buildings, because a lot of the designers I talk to on a day-to-day basis really want to design and build greener projects, but their clients may not always share the same goals, and there can be a real disconnect, particularly on bottom-line driven issues. Designers who are navigating this divide most successfully, I found, are doing it by paying close attention to what their clients really want and finding creative design solutions where sustainability is part of the toolkit to enhance outcomes on many different levels. As Chief Sustainability Officer for RTKL, my guest today, Lance Hosey, is passionately championing something he's calling performance-driven design, which not only is creating better outcomes on our RTKL projects at all levels, but he says it's raising the level of work done across the firm.
Lance Hosey, I want to talk today with you about what you call performance-driven design. But before we get to that, maybe could you start us off with an example of how you understand what matters to your client and how you add value through design? And there's an example involving multifamily housing that we quoted in our article that I'd love for you to share.
Sure. So performance-driven design is the strategy that we've developed at RTKL simply to improve value. And the point of it is that when we talk about green building or sustainable design in a general way, then we look at certain kinds of metrics, as energy, water, material, et cetera. Now, those kinds of topics don't always resonate with every client. It might be more bottom-line driven. So if we want to scale this and get more clients to embrace this, then the best way to do that would be to speak of this in language that they already understand. So the economic drivers tend to be the focus. Now, an example would be the one that you mentioned in multifamily residential is there's research that shows looking at housing projects, low-income housing projects, that more abundant landscape and vegetation leads to people having stronger feelings of community, they socialize more often, et cetera, et cetera. So the way that we've applied that in our work is, if you think about a value-added approach in a specific market in a multifamily residential setting where people are renting, one of the biggest challenges is how to increase renewals. So if you think about someone signs a lease on an apartment, whenever they give it up, then it costs the owner money. They have to renovate by painting and such. They have to advertise. They have some downtime with rent. So the name of the game there is to increase lease renewals. If you re-up your lease, then it costs the owner less money. Now, we have research from clients that show that people are 75% more likely to renew their lease in a multifamily residential building if they know at least one other person in the building, and they're 90% more likely if they know two or three people in the building. In other words, if you know a few people in the building and are friends with them, you're virtually guaranteed to renew your lease because you don't think of it as just a building, a place where you have an apartment. You think of it as your community. So what can we do and design to encourage more socialization so people meet more people in the building, have more friends in the building? And this research that I mentioned shows that having more abundant landscape is one way to do that. What's interesting about that is potentially counterintuitive. If you're in a dense urban setting, you wouldn't think of your landscape budget as being one of the primary drivers. But if you look at it this way, it could potentially get straight to the bottom line and around all the things that the client cares about. Now, so that's the entree to the topic. That is, how can we be as smart as possible in delivering value in the way that the client already understands value? The performance-driven design part of it is, how do we choose strategies that take that and also create value in other ways? So in this case, if abundant landscape is part of your strategy, that can potentially create more economic value in the ways I just described. It also creates more social value in the way I just described because of an increased sense of community, socializing more. But it also has an environmental value because it can shade the building more, it reduces stormwater runoff, it reduces the heat island effect, et cetera, right? So while we started with a sort of least common denominator goal, which is how do we make more money, depending on how smart we are, we can choose strategies that create value all the way across the triple bottom line.
And that's really, I wanted you to talk about your DART tool that you developed at RTKL, that those connections between strategies are embodied in that tool, correct? It's in a circle, and you can sort of start anywhere, no matter what is important to you, and you tend to come across the same strategies.
That's right. So what we found is when I joined RTKL 2 years ago, RTKL had never had a chief sustainability officer, and we sort of started from scratch and asking what are some of the baseline knowledge that we want people to have. And some of the ways we've done that is the way that everybody's doing it. We're increasing the number of people who are LEED accredited. For instance, in 3 months this year, we doubled our numbers so that I think 40% of our staff now, all inclusive, even admin, is LEED accredited compared to 20% last year. But some of the ways we're doing it is are the way I just described. How do we tailor the knowledge around sustainable design to those markets people work in? So the DART tool that we developed is organized in exactly the way that you described. We created this, or what we're calling a performance wheel, that takes a certain number of standard topics such as saving first cost, saving operating costs, et cetera. That's an example of economic value. Some of the social goals would be improving health and well-being, equity, engaging the community, and then on the environmental side, it's resources, habitat, climate, et cetera. And each of those becomes a spoke on this wheel, divided into the three triple bottom line categories. So we start with that. The first question we always ask through the performance-driven design perspective is, what are your goals in the project? What kind of value are you trying to create? Is it economic? Is it social? What is it? Start there. And then we use that to organize some smart strategies around pursuing that. So, for instance, if your initial goal is to save on the cost of construction, there are some traditional ways of doing that. Often the way we do it is a sort of shallow dive where you design something, you get a cost estimate back, it's a few percentage points above the budget, you go through so-called value engineering, eliminate some line items, come in under budget, everybody's happy, you move forward. But you've saved money without actually creating more value, and in fact you might be creating less value because presumably those original line items were in the budget for a reason. A slightly deeper dive might be to fine-tune the systems, sort of make the program more rigorous in terms of right-sizing the building layout, et cetera. You've created a little more value for the same amount of money. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is create as much value as possible across all the different ways that a value can be defined, social, economic, and environmental. But we're starting in that one place. So in this case, if you rely more on free resources such as daylight and outdoor fresh air rather than expensive resources such as artificial lighting and mechanically driven air, in some cases that can reduce your dependence on mechanical system by as much as two-thirds as a first cost. But it also, so you have started with one goal, which is reducing first costs, and depending on what strategy you've adopted, you can either create value in just that one area or all areas at once. In that case, those passive design strategies also can reduce operating costs over the life of the building. They also, spinning around to the environmental value side of what we call the performance wheel, you're also saving resources because you're consuming less energy. You are improving climate impact because of fewer emissions. You're also improving public health potentially because there are links between emissions and respiratory ailments. Going into the social value, all those same strategies are shown to have benefits for health and well-being. And then finally, you come all the way back around to economic, in that improved health and well-being can improve absenteeism, productivity, employee retention, et cetera. So you started with one simple least common denominator approach, which is save money. And depending on how smart you were in choosing strategies, you could either just save money or you could save more money but also create value in all these different areas. What we like about this approach is that it takes smart design, sustainable design, and translates it into terms that the clients and communities we serve understand, but it also makes it tailored to those different markets and communities. So, for example, if a client comes to us and says, you know, I'm really having trouble attracting and retaining good employees, so employee retention and recruiting is my single priority. And you say, great, and you pull out a lead checklist and you say, what are we doing about energy and water? It might seem as if you're not listening. Instead, what we're trying to do is say, how do you start with smart strategies that improve employee retention while also saving on resources and such? So it's just a matter of connecting the dots. What we think is unique about the DART is most resources of this kind start with the strategies themselves. So here's some information about daylighting. Here's some information about energy efficiency, passive ventilation, what have you. But you have to know to be interested in those topics in order to find them. If instead you ask, well, what is it you're trying to accomplish? Because daylighting is not necessarily the goal in and of itself. It's a strategy to achieve some other kind of goal. What is that goal?
So another, speaking of, you know, keeping your employees happy, another bottom line driven market you've applied this to is retail. And I think you've got some data on dwell time in retail settings that you have used to affect design and bring in other strategies than the usual, you know, energy, water, leak points, et cetera. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that's a great example of what I think is sort of the highest value that could be created in smart design today, but it's sort of falling through the cracks in the general discussion of it. In that, I sit on the USGBC's Market Advisory Committee, and one of the things we've been looking at is how to get more traction for lead in the retail space. So, internally here at RTKO, my colleague Heather Nelson looked at all of the retail certified projects ever done, because there really aren't that many of them. Retail is one of the markets that has been lagging around green building and sustainable design for a variety of reasons, trying to figure out what that is. The so-called business case isn't as clear as it is in workplace and healthcare and such. So we've been trying to figure that out. We did a credit-by-credit analysis of all the retail space that's ever been LEED certified and found that, by and large, people were not embracing indoor environmental quality strategies as much as you might think. It's daylight, fresh air, access to the outdoors, et cetera. Well, the irony is that relatively little research there is connecting sustainability to sales, which is the primary driver in that market, shows that people will gravitate towards products, buy more products in naturally lit spaces. There's the famous study of Walmart where they rotated inventory under the skylights and found that everything they put under the skylights sold more than everything else in the store. There's also research that shows, for instance, people are willing to pay more for products in stores that have abundant landscape in front of the storefront because they perceive it to be worth more, right? Both of those things relate directly to what in the LEED system is called indoor environmental quality, but those are the things that are being generally given a short shrift in LEED certified retail projects. So the irony here is that there's a growing number of people who in the retail space who are embracing LEED as one way to measure sustainable design. On the other hand, they're not focused on those strategies that would create the most value in that market. So what we call performance-driven design starts first and foremost with that. And a good example of that would be we define What we recommend as a process for every project is first clarify what goals you're trying to accomplish, then do some research into the different ways you can pursue those goals in order to develop smart strategies. And it's only then that we start designing. This is very different than a conventional design approach, which is client signed the contract this morning. What we're doing this afternoon is drawing shapes, because we think our value is basically making pretty pictures, right? If instead we clarify what it is we're trying to accomplish and then look at all the different ways we can do that, and then we start designing, we can get to a better solution faster because we're eliminating a lot of the options we might otherwise have pursued. In this case, the number one goal in a retail setting is always to increase sales. How do we spur sales? So research shows that for every 1% rise in dwell time, which means how long people linger in a space, there's more than a 1% rise in sales. It's 1.3. So the longer you get people to stay, the more they're going to buy, and it's not a one-to-one ratio. It goes up almost exponentially over time. So, and the average dwell time is something like 45 minutes in a large retail space. Any extra minute we can add is a spike in sales. Now, other research shows that people linger longer in places with daylight, fresh air, views, vegetation. They're comfortable there. For example, you don't necessarily think of a shopping mall as being the most aspirational architecture, but if you think of all the places in the world that people gravitate towards when they're on vacation, it's places like Siena, Barcelona, all the great public spaces of the world, they're essentially outdoor shopping malls. It's all retail, right? And that's to create more things for people to do, and it's multifunction. So, if you create a highly comfortable place through abundant daylight and natural ventilation, then potentially people will linger longer and buy more, right? That's pretty intuitive, but what we've been doing is studying, well, how do we use daylight analysis, thermal comfort analysis, and a lot of the retail work we do, we've been looking at how can we extend the number of hours in a given year that people are likely to dwell in a particular space, an outdoor space, either because we've made it slightly less cold in winter or slightly less hot in summer. And theoretically, the idea would be, well, if they're more comfortable, they might stay a little longer. Can we watch and see whether that actually has a spike in sales, right? So then that has an economic benefit, but those same strategies also have a social benefit because people are more comfortable. And they also potentially have a greater environmental benefit because they're lowering energy use, lowering the heat island effect, et cetera.
You're doing a lot of research to understand what your client needs, and you're finding amazing studies and pieces of insight that add value to these projects. How do you do that as a business and also meet your business objectives, you know, as a company?
Really great question. I know that we've debated about this internally for the last couple of years, and I know different firms approach this in different ways. I know some firms, like here in Timberlake, I think they earmark a certain percentage of their profit every year goes back into R&D. Some firms, their legal structure is such that they actually get a tax break if they take some of their annual revenue and invest it into these kinds of things. We have been doing it on a little more of an ad hoc basis. We have a couple of people at Artico, I think actually three people now who are full-time researchers, and in different markets we play in. The thing we're trying to get really smart about is how do we focus the research so we're looking at the right things, and how do we share the knowledge so that if somebody, you know, we're a 1,000-person global firm with 13 offices all over the world, and the way I've been putting it is, well, if somebody in Shanghai learns information that can be really valuable and somebody in Miami doesn't learn the same information, Shanghai's getting smarter and Miami isn't. So how do we connect the dots? And what's interesting is, small firm, if you're in the same space with all your colleagues, then the thought is that, well, I can walk across the room and ask Joe what he's working on, and I can learn that way, and sometimes that works that way, but you don't always do it. A large global firm has to be more efficient about how we share knowledge because you don't have the opportunity to walk across the room and talk to Joe, right? So we probably invest more than smaller firms do on a per capita basis into how we capture all this knowledge. So the performance-driven design, which we abbreviate as PDD, we created a PDD toolbox that we launched early this year. The DART was part of it. And part of it is also something we're calling the DASH, which is a database of project performance metrics, and it's quickly growing. And we're hoping to get to 100 projects at the end of the year. And some of the things we're learning from looking at our work is really just astounding. It's, for instance, we're finding that a lot of our work is reflecting larger trends in the industry. For instance, if you look at the energy savings across all of our work in this database and then look at this cost per square foot on average, it actually doesn't, we don't necessarily have to spend more to get higher energy savings, and that's consistent with research across the industry. On the other hand, if we're looking at what our leading edge projects are around certain metrics such as energy, this kind of analysis has made us realize that we're behind the curve in certain areas, so we know where to focus our attention in order to improve.
Great. Lance, thank you for speaking with us today on this Building Green podcast. If people want to see the DART for themselves and learn more about what you're doing, is there a place that they can go?
Sure. It's pdd-dart.rtkl.com. I think you can just Google RTKL and DART. Also, if you're going to Green Build, I'm giving a presentation there on data-driven designs, all the stuff we were just talking about. And finally, we are going to have a booth set up for the DART that some folks from RTKL are going to man, and you can learn more about it there.
Excellent. Thanks very much. This is Tristan Roberts with Building Green, and I've been speaking with Lance Hosey, Sustainability Director at RTKL. Thank you, Lance.